This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. After a week in which Watford, Hull City and Cheltenham Town celebrated promotion, and sadly Bristol Rovers, Swindon Town and Grimsby Town were relegated, we'll reflect on all the highs and lows of the past 7 days and the ones to potentially follow over the coming week across the Sky Bet Championship, League One and League Two on the official EFL podcast. Warning, this episode does contain references to mass footballers' sing-alongs and dad dancing. So, in the Sky Bet Championship, many congratulations to Watford, who, like Norwich City, are promoted back to the Premier League at the first time of asking. 17 wins in 25 games since Cisco Munoz took charge for the first time on Boxing Day, and an 8th consecutive home victory for the first time since 1977 saw them up with 2 games to spare. It's congratulations also to Brentford, to Bournemouth, to Swansea City and to Barnsley, who are the 4 teams who will contest the playoffs. Despite their best start since the mid-1980s, much improved Reading miss out. And at the bottom, with 2 games to go, Wycombe Wanderers are 6 points from safety and would need a huge swing in goal difference to survive, as well as winning both of their 2 remaining games. Derby sit just above the drop zone, having won just once in the last 13 games and having lost their last 5. Rotherham United and Sheffield Wednesday are 4 points behind them. Rotherham have a game in hand. Derby host Wednesday in the final game of the season. Your Sky Bet Championship fixtures this coming weekend: Huddersfield, who can still be caught by Rotherham, are at home to Coventry. Norwich need 2 more points to win the title and they face Reading. Rotherham play Blackburn. Sheffield Wednesday play Nottingham Forest. Derby are away at Swansea. Wickham entertain Bournemouth. Rotherham's game in hand, by the way, is next Tuesday. They're away at Luton Town. In Sky Bet League One, Hull City's form in finishing the season has been every bit as impressive as it was at the start. 10 wins and unbeaten last 13 matches is the longest current run in the EFL. It's led them to promotion back to the Championship at the first time of asking, and has taken influential midfielder George Honeyman. Well, let's be honest, George, into unfamiliar territory, because you are celebrating at the end of a season.
Oh, thankfully as well, because I think if I had one more summer going into it after a relegation or a playoff final defeat, it could have been the end of me, to be honest. So, but yeah, it's been a great season by everyone involved, and yeah, it's just amazing to finally, as you say, go into a summer on a happy note.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not doing this to ring you out at all, but just for the benefit of people that don't know, I promise you, because then we can enjoy your jubilation. 2016-17 relegated from the Premier League with Sunderland. 2017-18 relegated from the Championship. 18-19 lost the League One playoff final. And obviously, you switched to Hull that summer and got relegated from the Championship last season. So here's what I want to know.
It's not a great CV, that, is it?
Well, it is now, because it's all come together at the end.
Upward curve. Keep telling myself on upward curve.
So the final whistle goes at Sinsel Bank. Your emotions, please, Mr. Honeyman. What flushes over you at that moment?
I'd be lying if I say there wasn't a little bit of relief in terms of just getting the job done, because obviously we had the chance against Sunderland to go up if we won as well, or it gave ourselves a chance anyway. And you know, I felt like we had a bit of a nervy start at the start of that game, and I felt that was a lot because of the pressure. Obviously, a good pressure, but obviously I think we were a little bit nervous, and then we grew into the game. And again, it was Lincoln played really well against us on Saturday, and we were really up against it for majority of the game, and the lads just dug deep. And that relief that overcomes you, and it's sad to say it's relief, because it should just be pure joy, but definitely relief was the first emotion. And then just, yeah, the obviously the scenes in the dress room and at the training ground later on is when the joy comes out, and just to be able to celebrate with your good friends that are your teammates.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing the amount of times when that word relief comes up. I have literally been in around promotions before where you see almost the lifeblood drain out of somebody because they know that, well, you're only at 44 games, obviously, but effectively a season's work has reached the conclusion that you wanted. It's strange, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's obviously that there was obviously pressure on the club from being in League One for the first time in however many years to obviously bounce back as quickly as possible. I had the same feeling when, as you mentioned, when I came down with Sunderland and we were 90 minutes away from doing that. So to have that experience and then to do the same thing with Hull but come up straight away and to do it automatically is, it's something that I'll always be really proud of. And it's from day one we came in pre-season, our aim was to win the league and we're still very much hoping to achieve that this weekend, you know. The job's not done. It's been great that we've secured that automatic promotion because that is the main part of it. But now the league title's so close, it's, you know, we want to go and get those winners' medals round our necks, you know.
Listen, a lot of people are struggling at the moment as a result of what's been going on in the world for the last 13, 14 months. A lot of people have suffered disappointments. How did you get over yours? It's probably a decent nugget of life wisdom to share with everybody. Did you mope every summer? Did you get over it quickly? Did somebody have a word with you? Did you have a word with yourself? How did you get over it, George?
That's a really good question. Not one that I've sort of maybe told too many people about. And the answer purely is that there's no secret to it. It is gonna hurt, but like any sort of top athlete in any sport will tell you, you need to turn those hurts into a positive way that can motivate you. And football's a team game, a squad game, and there's a lot of stuff goes into a football club. So you may be wrong if you're someone like me or a lot of lads I've played with, if you take it all personally and think, oh, what could I have done better? Because if everyone had that attitude, you probably wouldn't have been relegated or been unsuccessful in the first place. But that attitude is what can make you as a player and as a better human in the future, because life's full of turbulent times. And in football, I think most footballers would tell you there's probably a lot more downs and ups in the game. And it's about staying level-headed, never getting too high, too low, and just every day applying yourself, like full on in everything you do, because there's always someone there trying to take your job. There's always like a player trying to take your position. And if you have a mope for a month, 2 months, then there's too many people out there that want your job. So you have to keep your head down, keep working hard. And it sounds like, well, that's obvious, but you'd be amazed at how many people don't do it or, you know, think they're working hard, but they're not really. And it's just like training anything. Hard work is all about train yourself to think that every day, to apply yourself every day. And it gets easier the more you do it, but it's never easy at the start, especially when you do come through difficult times.
Yeah, especially when you do it four seasons in a row as well, mate. But then you battle hardened that extra bit more, I guess, are you? But actually, what keeps you in a confidence that you're not stuck with the life of this, that at some point the corner will turn and tomorrow will be a good day?
I think you just got to have belief in what you're doing is correct. And as I said, sometimes it can get lost because you might be at a club where things aren't going right and you feel helpless, but you have to always stick to your beliefs. And if you truly believe that what you're doing is making you a better footballer and teammate, then you have to keep doing it and thinking that it's going to pay off in the end. And you are probably telling yourself lies at times and maybe it's not being truthful, but you have to just be pig-headed with it and be like, no, this, I believe in what I'm doing. I'm going to keep doing it and eventually I'll be successful with it. And some people might say that that's the wrong approach, but that's the kind of approach that I've had. And luckily enough, we've had a successful season as a club and it makes it feel 100 times better after the 4 previous seasons you've just told me about.
I mean, what I love as well about the sort of story of Hull this season is that several of you did suffer what went on at the back end of last season. You know, 16 defeats in the last 20, and obviously the whacking at Wigan, who ironically you play this current weekend, etc. There's a nucleus of you that have formed the core of this success. So it says a lot about the character of you all collectively that you've been able to bounce back in such a startling contrast to what you all suffered at the end of last season together.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's testament to the club and the coach and staff for keeping that faith in us, to be honest. And I don't think the club was far off. Listen, in January we lost two, you could argue, the best players in the Championship. Any club was going to be affected by it, but there was more to it than just that. But the club have recruited really well in the summer and then in January again. And as you say, we've had that core of us at the centre of the club, maybe he's pushing the values and standards, and we've had the backing of the coaching staff and backroom staff, and that it goes such a long way. But sometimes things like that can get overlooked in football, and even the manager staying on after last season, bringing that continuity and the owner having the belief in him, it's fair play to everyone involved, because as you say, it's not the most common theme in football. It's not the turnover in every club, playing staff, coaching staff is normally huge, and we haven't had as much as maybe other clubs, and we've been successful with it, and that's something that the club has to keep building on.
You did have that mid-season drift as well, because I mentioned the brilliant start, and it was brilliant, it was phenomenal, and the back end of results, but you did have that middle sort of, if you like, half of the season, the ratio of return was nothing like what it was at the start and what it's been at the end. Again, how did you find the mental strength not to allow that blip to become a trend that kind of ruined the campaign?
I'd be lying if we probably didn't let it affect it more than we should have, really. I mean, we've lost 10 games this season. That's a lot of games to lose to go up automatically. And that hurt us the most, I think, after Ipswich. We kind of... I wouldn't even say that there was harsh truth spoken, because it didn't even need to be said, but there was a feeling after that where it was like, well, this can't happen again. We were, you know... All of a sudden being in sort of the automatic spots all year to thinking we need to turn this around to keep in the playoffs. So we got lucky. We brought in some good lads in January again. We got maybe people that had been injured back in the fold. And to their credit, the coaching staff and the backroom staff have backed us all year and kept us really calm and just focused on just performances, really. And if we look at our squad, we always had that belief that if we just keep doing the basics well, keep thinking about our performance, we're going to have more than enough to get promoted here. And sometimes football is easier said than done, because people want to tinker or want to try and search for that magic formula, but we've all stuck at it and stuck to the same principles of what we set at the start of the end. Sorry, I'm just hearing music down my mic.
Yeah, I bet you are. I realised I'd asked you a lot of serious questions, so I thought I'd play a certain George Honeyman celebrating promotion.
God knows! Woo! God knows I want to break free!
I mean, who was that playing the guitar? It was brilliant.
It's Sean McLaughlin, one of our centre-halves. He is one talented boy, honestly. And then we had Big Tommy, he was playing later on, and Ryan, the analyst before that. I've never seen such a plethora of musical talent at one football club.
Well, and led by the beautiful rock star locks of the influential midfielder. Listen, you've not only got great musical prowess at the club, you've got some fantastic footballers. The pleasure you have given the supporters this season has been absolutely phenomenal. It's been great to talk to you, and I'm delighted for you personally. Listen, everything comes to he who waits, doesn't it? Do you want to sing us out, or shall we just say goodbye?
Saying goodbye today would be perfect for me. Thank you very much. As you can tell, my voice is a bit hoarse.
Otherwise you would. George, it's been an absolute pleasure. Congratulations from us.
Cheers, fellas. Thank you.
And just to clarify, Hull City will clinch the Sky Bet League One title on Saturday if they better Peterborough United's result. Peterborough themselves will confirm their own return to the Championship, in their case after an eight-year absence, if they avoid defeat against the only team that can still catch them, Lincoln City. Sunderland, Blackpool and Portsmouth occupy the other playoff places at the bottom. Bristol Rovers' five-year stay in the division is over, as is Swindon Town's, just 12 months after they won the Sky Bet League Two title. Even wins this coming weekend may not be enough to stop Rochdale and Northampton Town joining them. Your fixtures this coming weekend: Charlton are 2 points off the playoffs with a game in hand, travel to Accrington Stanley. Wimbledon, who need a point to be sure of survival, having won 4 and drawn 2 of the last 6 games, entertain Portsmouth. Hull entertain Wigan, have dropped just 2 points from the last possible 15, but still need a win to secure their own survival. It's Northampton against Blackpool. Peterborough against Lincoln, who've won 4 of their last 5. Sunderland travel to Plymouth. Rochdale, 11 points from their last 15, entertain Doncaster Rovers. And Oxford, who are a point off the playoffs, travel to Shrewsbury Town. And then next Tuesday night, it's Blackpool against Doncaster Rovers, and Charlton entertain Lincoln City. Shall we have another blast of George Honeyman? I think we should.
God knows! Woo! God knows I want to break free!
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Between 3 o'clock this Friday, the 30th of April afternoon, and a minute to midnight next Monday, the 3rd of May, all of English football's main stakeholders from the men's and women's game will unite for a social media boycott in response to the ongoing and sustained discriminatory abuse received online by players and many others connected with the game. It's been scheduled to coincide across a full fixture programme, and it's going to see all clubs switch off their Facebook, Twitter and Instagram accounts. The game recognises the considerable reach and value of social media to the sport, but the boycott aims to emphasise that social media companies must do more to eradicate online hate and highlight the importance of the ongoing fight against discrimination. Well, the EFL is one of the collective, as is football's equality and inclusion programme. Kick it out, and we can talk to their chairman, Sanjay Bhandari. And I guess my first question, Sanjay, has to be, is this football or society's problem?
It can be both. It doesn't have to be an either or. And I think the reality is it is both. It is a societal problem, but it is also a football problem, because these problems play out acutely in football. So, you know, the reality is that discrimination, abuse, racism ebbs and flows over time. And it depends what time frame you're looking at. If I said, is the situation better now than it was 50 years ago, maybe when I started watching football in the mid-70s, I'd say, of course it's much better. You know, it's easier for someone like me to go to a game. It's a more welcoming place. But is it worse than it was, it maybe in the high watermark in 2012 after the London Olympics, when the feel-good factor around this country was incredible? Undoubtedly, it's worse. And the external data supports that. There's a rise in hate crime statistics over the last 4 or 5 years. So, of course, and society is feeling like it's much more divided and polarised. And, of course, those things play out much more acutely in football. And there are some very specific things about football, because football has always been tribal. And in some ways, the rest of society is becoming like football. It's becoming more tribal. And we have the anonymity of the crowd. People do things in crowds which they wouldn't do if they were, you know, walking down the street, and it inflames passions. So you combine those factors, and of course, anything that's going on in society, it plays out differently and more acutely in football. The difference this time, and the challenge on this sort of wave, because progress goes in waves, the challenge in this wave is that social media is the primary mechanism of communication for modern society, and that is like real life on steroids. So everything that plays out in real life, the divisions in real life, get exacerbated and exaggerated online. And of course, the anonymity of the crowd, that's mimicked with the anonymity online. So of course you have this sort of perfect storm. So the answer is, it can be both, and it is both.
Obviously, we're here to talk about the social media boycott, but I'm really glad you mentioned the tribal nature of football, because let's be perfectly frank, mate, people have been getting away with things in football grounds for decades that you would not get away with in the street. I've also seen so much spill on to public transport in and around matches as well. I've seen entire train carriages paralysed by 12 horrible individuals fueled up on drink who support a club and come on and ruin a journey for perfectly good people. So is football paying a little bit of a price for failing to police its own backyard over the past, well, as you say, it could go back as far as 50, 60 years, to be honest.
I think actually there's an interesting another point in there, which is how people behave when they're watched and when they feel like they're being watched or they're being supervised. So the things that you describe actually take a journey to a ground. You know, if you're on the tube or you're on the bus or you're on the tram or you're on the train, right, where maybe you're not being supervised, you're not being watched, there's no British Transport Police, you know, that behaviour there might be a bit more rowdy. You get in and around the ground where it's stewarded and it's policed. That has changed over 30 years. That is, you know, people suddenly, you know, behave themselves because they feel they're being watched. You go inside the ground, you might get inflamed by what happens on the pitch and that might change your behaviour. But by and large, because people feel like they're being watched, they'll moderate their behaviour. Maybe except for an away end, because no one sits in their seat in an away end. So you're never going to get tracked. So the behaviour in an away end is another sort of another dimension. And then you go back again out of the ground and it's that same thing. People go in and out of bad behaviour, good behaviour. And actually, that's mirrored online. The problem online, it's not supervised, it's not regulated, no one's watching, there's no consequences, it's a free shot, I can do what I want, I'll behave how I want.
I have to object to some of what you said. I still think there have been sporadic moments that have been brushed under the carpet. Didn't Steve Bruce get a large vegetable thrown at him in the Aston Villa dugout? I can remember Steve McClaren at Middlesbrough having season tickets pelted at him when people didn't like the response in a particular season. We've all seen an away manager, maybe one that's quite confrontational. He's digging in the ear of the fourth official, getting pelters from a little pocket. And I do think that sometimes football, because of mob rules, because it might be a cluster of 6, 10, 20 individuals, that it might be hard to move out. If they have a fiery 30 seconds, 45 seconds, a minute, it's easier to watch it start to dissipate and let it go than it is to go to those people and say, you couldn't do that to your local shopkeeper if you were unhappy because he's run out of tin tomatoes. That's the point I'm making, Sanjay.
Yeah, and there is probably a broader cultural point, isn't there, which is that there's always been banter between crowds. It's part of what needle is part of what makes English football what it is and why it's so attractive to a global audience. That idea of two rival sets of fans singing at each other, and you know, there's nothing better than when you hijack the other side's chant and turn it round in a funny way. I think part of the challenge is, you know, my sense over the last 30, 40 years watching the game and going to games is some of that needle and banter has turned pretty aggressive, actually, and it's become a bit more toxic. And some of the humour has actually gone out of the game. And I think that's something we should lament. And that's because, and part of that, actually, I still think it goes back to how do we communicate? And there's still the primary method of communication is social media. And I was reading something, I think it was in the FT last weekend, saying, if you look at the tone on social media, the default tone of conversation is snarky. It's that sort of know-it-all in a quick sentence. My aim is to cut your legs from underneath you all the time. And that is, I think that tone, that sort of constantly pernicious tone, eats out into real life. You know, which one feeds each other? You know, did it start in the real world and go online? Did it start online and go in the real world? Or are they both sort of spinning each other up? So I think there is a broader cultural tone piece. And have football missed some opportunities? Look, there is clearly this sort of culture of abuse. And actually, this is the most horrific end of it that we're talking about, the horrific misogyny and homophobia and racism. But also, actually, is that there's just the abuse that doesn't contain that discriminatory stuff. There's still that culture of abuse, and we have to change that as well. That's a societal piece. It's gone from being funny to being nasty.
And I guess as well, it's quite worrying at what might be below the surface, because if these are the nuggets that are prepared to actually go on the record, albeit in an unregulated way by the social media companies, how many more people are there below the surface who hold similar views, are in the heat of something they're not happy about, will let these hideous views come out of themselves that don't take to social media? That, I guess, is a worry as well, that this is just the tip of the iceberg, isn't it, Sanjay?
Well, people are just easily led. And very often people are just easily led and just join in with anything. You know, there's a sort of... that's my team. My team's doing that, so I'm going to join in with it. So there is a bit of that mentality, and we've seen that, you know, with some incidents in the past where you interview the fans afterwards and say, well, I'm not really sure I believed in that. I was just joining in. And so there's an element of just joining in, and can you turn that as a positive? Well, join in this thing instead, because we're all doing this, join in this positive thing.
It's brilliant what you're doing this weekend. One thing stood out for me, which was talk of the importance of highlighting real life consequences for purveyors of online abuse. Are we ready to try and single out some ringleaders, some fall guys or girls who have to be made an example of and shown that there will be consequences down the line, that if you espouse those hideous views on one platform, you can quickly be found on another platform and it might have consequences in your professional life, in your personal life. And there are going to be some people out there who will, they're going to be hurt as a result of the hurt that they've caused.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to, because at the moment, it's what I'd call a culture of impunity. People do whatever they want because there are no consequences. So you have to create some real world consequences for that behaviour. You know, being taken off the platforms is part of that. But really, when things cross a threshold of the criminal law, those social media companies really need to be much faster in helping support law enforcement agencies when they request information so that we can actually turn these into prosecutions. Because I think unless people can see that there's a real world consequence, they'll just carry on doing it.
Are we expecting such a sort of short, sharp shock to make any difference to individual behaviour? Or do you think the vast majority of this boycott is aimed at the social media companies? Do you think there might be any subliminal washdown to the sort of actual users who might just clean up their behaviour ever so slightly? Or is that a side issue to the main front of this boycott?
I think whenever you have something high profile like this, you'll get some people that will change their behaviour and it'll make them think again. But that's not the principal aim of this boycott. It's really much more focused on getting social media to take responsibility and to take action. Look, this is about, I suppose, three things. It's about signalling from football our collective anger at the abuse and the damage that that abuse causes to the people who play in, watch and work in the game. It's about demonstrating unity with those victims. And it's about creating a symbolic gesture which, if widely implemented, sends a signal to those with power. And it says to those people with power, you need to do something, you need to act, you need to create change. And the primary companies with the ability to create change are the social media companies. To a degree, there's government, because, of course, they can legislate and there's some legislation in line, and we will help and support them with that to go as fast as possible. But really, this is a technology problem, and these companies make money out of this technology. So if you have got the sophistication that I can go on a website, look at a pair of trainers, and 5 minutes later when I go on Facebook, those same pair of trainers pop up in my feed, then you can solve this problem because you've got the technology. So if you're using the technology to sell us stuff, point it in another direction and use it to get hate off your platforms.
Good luck with it, Sanjay. Keep up the great work.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me on.
This is the official EFL podcast.
So we've already learned that Hull City midfielder George Honeyman and his teammates celebrated promotion to the Sky Bet Championship with a rendition of I Want to Break Free that would have made Queen themselves proud. But in Sky Bet League 2, how did Cheltenham Town manager Michael Duff react to his club's return to League 1 after a two-year absence? I'm describing it as part dad dancing, little bit of a sort of Scar two-tone shuffle, little bit of a lawnmower in there for me, Michael, as well, and a little bit of a drunk stomping on his way home. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that's about right. I'm probably the drunk stomping home is probably the most fitting one. It's become synonymous with me. I'm not quite sure how. I say famously. I did it at Wembley when we won promotion with Burnley. It was a bit of a thing in the dressing room. Owen Coyle's soap suits just made me do it, and we won. So then, luckily, I had another two promotions with Burnley, and every time the dance came out. So I didn't know the lads knew about it, to be honest, but they started egging me on last night. So I duly obliged. So if I keep getting promoted, I'll keep bringing the dance out because it's the only time it does come out.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there's quite a lot of energy exertion in it as well. So if you're planning on any more promotions and bringing it out again, you might need to start doing a little fitness regime just to make sure your aerobics up to speed with that ferocity.
I think it's getting shorter and shorter as the years go on. I know that.
I love the fact your past is catching up with you. Listen, the other thing that George Honeyman shared with us was the emotion on the final whistle when the mission is achieved was relief. Is that something you can relate to?
Yeah, I think I've actually texted a few people today, managers, and that I've absolutely shattered last night. A completely different emotion to a player. As a player, I enjoyed the moment and, you know, you're together with all the lads, but on this side of the fence now, you know, there's a lot of emotion, a lot of work goes in, and the players deserve all the credit, but it was a relief. You know, last night we went 1-0 down, we got ourselves back in it. Carlisle had to win. So we ended up playing, we were playing 6-2-2 for the last 10 minutes of the game because they were absolutely, you know, we normally play with a back five, we put another one on because it was coming in from everywhere. So it was, and like you say, the final whistle was pure relief, but there's a lot of work, a lot of emotions gone into the whole season. So to get over the line and with a couple of games to go, you know, it was, relief was probably the right word.
Yeah. I mean, I love the fact, I mean, you talk about emotions, but you played this card in the dressing room, didn't you? Didn't you get a load of the players' families, wives, whatever it was, to sort of send messages to sort of will them on and things, which I'm imagining brought a few tears to eyes?
Yeah, it was quite emotional. I'm not sure it was the right thing to do because we were turgid in the first half. but we've sort of touched on it in the last couple of weeks because there's no fans there. Sometimes it's a little bit disconnected in terms of what it actually means to the town. So over the Easter period, we showed them, it was when I was actually playing. There was a famous game at our club. We played Rushton and Diamonds. There was people queuing up round the block and just to show what it means to the local area. And then we managed to trick them. We got the captain to say that the chairman wanted to do something so that the players weren't actually aware of it. And just messages from their loved ones. You know, there was an opportunity to be heroes for the supporters, for the town, but also for the people that want to be there watching you. So it was quite emotional, and we'll stick that on a USB stick and we'll show them and we'll give it to them at the end of the season, so something for they can carry for the rest of their, you know, careers or the rest of their lives.
What comes into a manager's head on that whistle? I mean, talked about the emotion. Is there a person? Is there a situation? Do you think of somebody at that precise moment when that whistle toots?
No, I think, like you said, it's just relief. It was, you know, because we were so much under the cosh in that last 5 minutes. It was a long 5 minutes, and then obviously your phone blows up and you get the interaction with the players, and you know they all have the pictures taken. It feels a bit surreal, a little bit forced. But I kept telling them, get more pictures taken, get more champagne up, because they're making memories, and because there's no fans there, they have to generate themselves. And to be fair, after 5 minutes, they sort of took it on themselves, and it was actually really, really good.
Okay, what time did you get home? What kind of time did you shut the door?
I wasn't too bad. I had my two boys there. I had two boys, so I was home by midnight.
The boys obviously went to bed because they got to go to school and stuff. Are you straight to bed, or did you have a little sit in your own space on your own and just have a little think about everything that's happened? Or did you risk falling asleep if you did that?
No, like I said, I was absolutely shattered. So, you know, I was probably asleep by 12:30, but I was wide awake at 5 o'clock this morning. So wow. That's when I started replying to, and I'm not normally up at that time. I'm actually a good sleeper, but just replying to messages and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of texts and WhatsApps. And I thought, well, I was wide awake, so I might as well start replying to him. So it's, and that's when it starts sinking in of how many people are wishing you well and how much it means to so many different types of people, that are connected, not just me personally, but to the football club.
Yeah. I mean, you've got this incredible CV. I mean, you're believed to be the only player to have played in English football's top eight divisions, three promotions with Cheltenham. You scored the goal that brought them in the league. You mentioned your promotions to the Premier League with Burnley as well. Where would this achievement rank, do you think?
I think it's probably the highest in terms of it's my team. Yeah. As a player, you're a small cog, you know, you're one of 20, 25 players. But to be the leader of this group, you know, I'm immensely proud. When we came in, we weren't very good. And the group have been good the whole way along. and to recover from the disappointment of last year in the playoffs. Obviously, I think we broke a record of being the only team to win the first leg 2-0 away from home and get beat. So that wasn't a record that we wanted. So to lead this the same group and to get it done this season, against all the odds, you know, we're not a big team. And there's some big teams in this league this year. So, yeah, I think that this was probably my favourite one. Lucky to, like you said, that's my seventh promotion now. I'm lucky that I definitely class this as my favourite one.
Wow. At what point did you realise management was a route you wanted to go down, Duffer?
Quite early. I was 29 and I had a career, well, potentially career-ending injury. I did my cruciate ligament, my lateral ligament, my hamstring tendon. You got a cap burst, my capsule in my nip, did it all. And it was, well, I've got 3 years left on my contract here, so what am I going to do? So I thought, well, I might as well get some qualifications for the only thing that I know. So that's what got me in the coaching badges. Luckily, I managed to play another 9 years, got to 38. But by then, I was well on down the road with coaching. I appreciated football more, because it nearly got taken away from me. So I looked at the game differently. I treated my body differently. You know, 3 promotions to the Premier League after the age of 31. So incredibly lucky to play under some good managers. But more towards with Deitchy, really, that's when I really started drilling down on how does he talk, how does he present things, his analysis, his meetings, what he says that I like. That, and I started picking his brain. And ultimately, I got to 38 and he said, right, I'm taking the playing option away from you now. If you want to play, you've got to play elsewhere, or there's a coaching job for you. And at 38, 600-odd games, 700 games, I thought, no, this is my in. You know, it's hard to get in. So I had 2 great years coaching under him, under 18s, under 23s. And then this opportunity came around, and it was, I didn't want to be that bloke in the pub. I've said it before. You know, you always got that bloke, 50, 60-year-old bloke, oh, I could have done that. I didn't want to be that man that was saying I could have done it. I wanted to give it a go. I'm only 100-odd games in, so I'm not saying I've cracked it by any means, but you know, if I get sacked tomorrow, I'll have had 100-odd league games and a promotion, so I've done okay so far, but it's been a long time coming.
At what point did you realise you were pretty good at it? Don't be modest, because it's a fair question, isn't it? At what point, because I'm guessing your young manager trying to establish their principles picks up a squad that's perhaps not of their sort of players, not in particularly good form. But at what point did you think, okay, I'm making a difference here?
Probably after Christmas. So I got appointed in the September and I didn't win a game for 10 games. So I can show you now, I didn't think I was any good at it at that point. But from the Boxing Day of that year, we would have actually finished 6th in the league. We finished 16th, but the form would have been from Boxing Day on would have been 6th. So we'd started to change it at that point. And I could sort of see messages that when I'm saying things and then you're listening to the players' press when they're getting interviewed and they're saying things that I'm saying. So you're like, oh, okay, maybe that's resonating now. That's getting through to them now. And the results were picking up. So they start buying into it a little bit more. And ultimately, last season, you win a manager of the month, which is, it's a team thing, but you get the personal accolade. And it's like, well, I think we might be onto something here. Ultimately, we fell short last year. But again, people, messages that you've got to use it as fuel, you've got to use it as motivation. It's easy to say all these things, but there's got to be the authenticity within it and an honesty and a hard work. We're like, okay, we're going to have to try and improve on last year. How are we going to do that? And the players deserve all the credit, because they're the ones that come in every day and try to get better. There's no assassins in the group. There's no sappers who, you know, they're in a bad mood, so they want to go and tell 3 other people they're in a bad mood, and they put them in a bad mood. It's a really positive environment, and that's when you think, well, maybe my influence is helping the group.
Well, listen, the leader sets the tone for that, don't they? The other part of this dynamic is obviously your relationship with the area, which is, I think I'm right in saying, of your own family kind of moved into the area. You've certainly married a local girl, like obviously the boys are at school there and things. I mean, how big a determining factor do you think that has been, feeling like you're part of your own?
That's the reason I took the job. I just spent quite a lot of money doing up an old house in Manchester, because we thought, right, this is it. We're going to live in Manchester for the rest of our lives. And this job, I didn't apply for the job. The Cheltenham job came up. the kids were the right age in terms of my oldest was in his last year of primary school. It's not a sacking club. It was a first team job. It was like all the stars seemed to line up. And it's like, right, come on, let's have a go. And now, like I said, my wife's, all their family live in Cheltenham. All my family now live in Cheltenham or Gloucester. And this is home now. No matter what happens to me, if I get sacked tomorrow or move on tomorrow, the family will always be in Cheltenham. So it does mean a lot. It means, you know, I've said to the lads a few times, I have to live in the town. So you need to leave the club in a better state than what you left it. And it's not until recently, because we've been doing quite well, you don't realise how many people actually know you in the town. Because we're going well, people want to say well done. You know, I played golf last week at my local golf course, and on nearly every hole I got stopped. And that's not happened before. So, but it means that people, it means that the team are doing well. But it does, it's, you know, there's definitely an emotional pull.
Are the club ambitious? Do they think they can go further? Are they going to be stretching you and your resources to the extreme in the next division up? Because you're up against some big clubs, let's be honest, Michael.
Yeah, well, I think it came out the other day, I think we're 17th or 18th budget in League Two. So I think it's fair to say we'll be in the bottom two or three in League One. It's a challenge. The club's never finished above 17th in its history. So it's another opportunity to break a record. I'll be trying to get as much as I can. The one thing the club won't do is they won't bet the ranch. They just won't do that. So they operate within their means, which is why we've survived during this pandemic. And we'll have to find ways, we'll have to be creative, and we'll just have to try our best. I don't think there'll be any sort of expectation in terms of going on or finishing top tens. It's like, you know, the first and foremost, we'll be trying to finish fifth bottom. It doesn't sound very ambitious, but it's a hell of a challenge. You look at the teams that went up last year, I think two look like they're going to go down, and they're bigger clubs than us. But from a player's point of view, you're playing against better players, you're playing in big stadiums and some big clubs in that league. That's what you want to do as a player. You want to play at the highest level in the pyramid.
Are you ambitious?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to manage at the highest level. I managed to do it as a player, and it took me a long time. Like you said earlier in the interview, I started in Tier 8, and it took me to 31 to get to the Premier League. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to get to the Premier League, but the drive's there. That's the ambition. But I'd like to think that every manager in our league would say the same thing. I don't think I'm saying anything controversial or big-headed. That's the drive, that's the ambition. Very, very unlikely I'm going to get there. But as long as I can look in the mirror when I'm 60 years old and say, I gave it a good go, then I'll be happy with that.
Mate, if you've been the career path that you have been, and you've been through those eight divisions and arrived in the Premier League at 31, you know that what feels impossible at one stage can be possible, don't you? Anything is possible.
Yeah, well, the drive was always there. I didn't go shouting from the rooftops. You know, but as a player, the drive was always there. I didn't need to tell anyone else because they don't need to know. But from a managerial, I'm no different. I'm the same person. I want to do whatever I do. You know, when I play golf, I get annoyed when I don't play as well. I'm competitive. It's built in. But you need to be able, you need to be prepared to work hard, and you need to be able to be honest with yourself as well, and recognise when you're not as good as what you could be, and all those types of things. Because the one thing that I think does help me in terms of, I've played at every level, so I don't get that. I've been a League Two player, so I understand sometimes you hear stories of top internationals that they struggle because the players can't do what they expect them to be able to do. Well, there's a reason why most players are in League Two. Now, some are young and on the way up, some are old on the way down, and some are just League Two players. But it's trying to get the best out of them and give them the tools that can help them be better.
Listen, congratulations on your magnificent achievement. Have you done the debrief with Daishi yet? Was Sean one of the first ones on the phone? Did you just join Daishi? Exactly what happened? Did he give you a call early doors?
I've not spoke to him. I think he was probably the first or the second person to text me when the final whistle went, which tells you everything about the man, really. But I'll catch up with him in the next few days, I'm sure. But not just him, obviously, lots and lots of people. People that I didn't even knew me, congratulating me. And it's great, even managers in our league, that you don't have that much of a relationship there, your competitors, but you know, half the league's probably text me, well done and congratulations. So that means a lot as well from, you know, your peers.
That's absolutely brilliant. Oh, wait a sec. I've got a text here. I wonder if it's for you. Oh, it is for you. It's Strictly. They want to know if they can have your number, mate, for the next series. Do you want me to pass it on?
No, like I said, that's too early on a Saturday night. If we did it at 2 o'clock in the morning, I might be able to take you up on it. I need a few more drinks for me.
Get those arms going. What a joy. Congratulations, mate. Brilliant work.
Cheers, Clem.
There he goes. Well worth a watch if you get a chance, that celebratory dance. It's a little bit manic. It's very, very short, but it's gone viral, so you shouldn't find it too hard to stumble across. Chelham Town can win the Sky Bet League 2 title this weekend. If they win their match and other results go their way, but wins for Cambridge United and Bolton Wanderers would seal the other two automatic promotion places. Morecambe Tranmere Rovers, Newport County and Salford City, after three consecutive wins, currently occupy the playoff places at the bottom. Sadly, Grimsby Town's five-year stay back in the Football League was ended after a late midweek defeat to Exeter City. Southend United will join them unless they can win both of their two remaining games, and Scunthorpe United or Colchester United lose both of theirs with a significant swing in goal difference. Your Sky Bet League 2 fixtures this coming weekend. Well, Cambridge can be promoted on Friday night away at Harrogate Town, and then on Saturday, Southend travel to Barrow, Bolton entertain Exeter City, who are now 2 points off the playoffs, Scunthorpe travel to Bradford City, Colchester, who need another point to be mathematically safer at home, to Salford, Forest Green Rovers, who've dropped out of the playoff positions, entertain Tranmere, it's Newport who entertain Cheltenham Town, and Morecambe travel to Walsall. That's it for this episode. A big thank you to Michael Dad Dancing Duff, Sanjay Bandara and George Warble Tonsils Honeyman. If you've enjoyed it, please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Thanks very much for listening. Join us again soon for another episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.